Welcome to Rec Addict After Hours. I've just come fresh from an almost 50-mile bike ride today, so I'm very tired.
50?
Almost.
Jesus Christ, you're mental.
But that number is very special today. We've hit the half century, not chronologically speaking, of course, the half century of episodes, Rec Addicts After Hours, episode 50. Welcome. Thank you for listening. My name is Ben. We've also got Telmo and Pete, long-standing members of the crew here. And we've got a lovely podcast to deliver to you. We're, of course, very far away from each other. I can't even see Telmo. He's that far away. Put your lights on, Telmo.
Okay. Is it that? That's the one, isn't it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
No.
That one.
I was meaning that you're in car thing, so I can actually see your beautiful face.
Oh, okay. What about now? Hang on. Hello, Ben.
There he is.
It's me, baby.
Telmo really is two cars away from me. We're stringing XLRs and headphone cables between them, and it's quite hilarious to look at.
Staying strong.
Yeah, hope people don't think we're doing something illicit in this car park. Anyway, how are you lovely gentlemen on this auspicious occasion?
Not too bad.
Yeah, that's good.
How about?
Yeah, man, I'm great. I'm okay, apart from the old COVID thing that happened to me this week. But everyone's got a bit of that.
Do tell. Well, you're actually fine. You just got the old notification, didn't you?
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. Just to be aware, listeners, I don't have COVID. So
you can't catch it over the internet. I'm sure there's somebody who thinks you can. No. You can't catch COVID over the internet. Fear not. This podcast is not infected. Nice. What have you been up to? You shorter isolation period. You didn't go insane like our first countrywide lockdown.
Yeah, there were moments, you know.
Cabin fever.
Yeah. No, it's the usual. So this week I've been tracked from the app, the NHS app, saying that I've been in contact with someone that has been tested positive. Therefore, I did a couple of tests as I've been feeling a bit of that cold and flu, which is normal at the time of the year, but you know, it's better safe than sorry. So after doing that, I have the pleasure to announce that I've obviously negative.
You're safe.
I'm safe, which is a great relief. So I went back to doing my usual business, which is not much anyway, but university work at home. I actually did some quite interesting studies this week.
Ooh, do tell.
Which included 19th century opera, which is actually far more fun than you would imagine.
I was thinking, rather you than me.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of opera until I found out that Wagner, which is like the opera god.
I've heard the surname.
Of in Germany, he built his own massive basically opera house specifically for him with the sort of standards that he wanted, and this includes very early sort of like acoustics design. So he had the band in a specific way. So back in the day, the band used to be right in front of the stage, so that it would be
classic arrangement.
Yeah, classic arrangement, like Shakespearean kind of type of hall. But he decided to have the band a few levels below the stage, so the sound, so within like some sort of like encased sort of like space where the sound would be projected upwards into the people. So it's literally the first sort of like experiment towards what we now call IMAX cinema experience, which is very interesting to study the acoustics of that.
Nice one.
Yeah.
Next level from the amphitheater, of course.
Yeah. So that was fun, and did some composing and piano compositions based on animals, which was really cool.
Interesting.
That's to sum it up, to be honest.
Excelente. Pete, you took some holiday. Have you holidayed?
No, not really. I've been in the joys of preparing my company accounts for auditing.
That sounds absolutely
for
thrilling.
The Inland Revenue, which I have to, it's mandatory that it has to be done.
Big numbers?
Not really. But my accountant had contacted me to give me a nudge. I tend to, I'm not that hot on it in respect to, I mean, when the end of the financial year, which is April, or the beginning of the financial year is April, the end is March. You have from March till the end of December to get your accounts ready and into the Inland Revenue in the UK. This is mine. In my case, it's for a limited company. And mostly I've been just sort of, my head has been in the accounting software, just trying to get all the books straight, just get all the numbers straight. There's always those weird, spurious bits of, what was that? What's this receipt? What's going on? it's the reconciliation of the bank account against the invoices that go in and out. It's all pretty pretty hideous, to be honest.
So roughly how many hours did it take you to do that?
I'm still doing it. It's actually going to take it last week and this week. It normally takes me a couple of weeks. I mean, I really should do it as I go. I mean, I obviously do the accounts as I go, and I have to do VAT, sales tax, every 3 months. That has to be calculated and then submitted to the government for any monies that you might have to pay them. But the one thing I don't do, which I should do, is reconcile the bank accounts. And I should really do it on a monthly basis, but I don't have that many transactions. It's not a big company, and I tend to sort of save it all up and do it at the end of the year. But it's generally quite hideous. I mean, I'm used to the process.
It's like exam period, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those things you just know that you've just got to knuckle down and do it, and hopefully there won't be too many strange anomalies where you're sort of, because you want to do it absolutely to the penny. I mean, you can sort of make adjustments if you're a few pennies out here and there, but generally you want to get it absolutely on the nail. So there's always these spurious costs that you just can't remember what it was. You don't seem to have any documentation. I mean, that type of thing. But I'm getting there. I'm mostly done. Done the main bank account. The next one is the PayPal account, because that is a technically another bank account.
Yep.
And that has to be reconciled. And then the last thing will be the petty cash that has to be reconciled, which is generally the one that really is a head scratcher, because it's basically cash. So you've got to work out where those sort of weird out of pocket expenses and bits and pieces went. But hopefully I shall be finished before the end of next week, and that will be me sort of done for the year in that respect.
Well, so once again, rather you than me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I could. I mean, I already pay my accountant a set fee every month, and that accumulates so that he is fully paid up when it comes to him sort of assessing the accounts. Because it's a limited company, you have to have a chartered accountant sign the accounts off. So it's a legal document you produce. So he produces, once I've submitted all the electronic files to him, he will spend some time working on it, and then he will produce several reports. There'll be a sort of short form 4-page report, which I have to sign in multiple places, and he also countersigns. And then there'll be a long form one, which is about 9 pages, which he again has to sign and I have to sign. So it's quite important stuff, but that's what you have to do when you run a company.
Yeah.
But yes, I'll be...
Well done to you, mate.
Yeah, well I'll be relieved when it's all done.
Yeah,
definitely. When we move into the newsy kind of section, I reckon we start with a quick fire synth round before we get into some of the juicier ones. We've got a couple here pre-prepared by Pete. One that we've actually mentioned before, but I'm going to go through a few quick nuggets for you. One that I found maybe last week and then forgot about. Modor synths, not Modal, Modor. Styling is very similar, which gets incredibly confusing. Anyway, they've got a DSP drum machine, which looks just the business. Very interesting way they've made the sequencer nice and friendly. Multiple tracks, all the synth engines can be on any of the tracks, you know, so it's versatile and cool and sounds pretty beastly. And then I thought, oh yeah, maybe let's have a look at the €1,700. Ooh, oh well. I'm sure it'll be exciting.
Ouch.
But it's definitely boutique, so maybe we'll have to leave that one for the YouTube demos, of course, as always. Another one perhaps we should look at, a couple of visitations from the B word this week. The first one, the Beremin.
Oh.
For $99.
Is that a theremin, but by Behringer?
Exactly.
Yes!
Again, they're working on it. We'll probably see it in 5 years. Who knows? It does look kind of cool. Actually, it reminds me of a Marshall guitar, like amp head.
What?
Because it's all gold and black and red switches, which is kind of cool. Little fold-up pitch antenna. pretty interesting. Theremins are annoying anyway, so I don't really care that much. The other one, the Behringer Swing, which is a direct rip-off of the Arturia Keystep. So they're going after smaller companies
oh,
now.
Wow, look
and
at them.
And modern stuff. So that's an interesting move. And I'm scared, but also quite interested to feel them fall apart when we get them in the shop.
To be honest, it's quite a bold move because they're taking over some of the modern stuff as well.
And if you look at it, it's so similar. We've got the same size key bed, the same format in terms of the lettering across the top of the keys where you can change MIDI channel and things, the same pitch and mod touch strips, the same four buttons on the left, the same three dials, the same transport controls. It's a complete rip-off. And this, I think, this is probably the Behringer thing that has upset me the most. It's quite annoying.
Yeah,
that they're not even trying to do anything new. Actually, the IO on the back is identical.
Oh my god,
that's absolutely nuts.
I wonder what our listeners think of this.
Yeah, well, take a look. If you go on ask.audio, there'll be pictures. You can find it quite easily. Behringer Swing. That's pretty irritating. And then another article I found is actually quite juicy, and Pete's popped it at the end, so I think we'll visit that in a bit. But the larger ones, the Erica Synths Black Sequencer. This one I totally skimmed over, Pete. Have you had a good nose at this one? You're an
yeah,
Erica
watched,
kind of guy sometimes, aren't you?
I think it was the Low Pop video that I watched earlier today, just to sort of catch up on the details. And it's quite interesting, the functionality of this thing. He did say that his version was sort of pre-production, so the firmware wasn't quite up to snuff, and there was a few things that were coming down the pipe which were sort of promised. But it did look quite interesting. The functionality was quite... Because these sort of attenuators on the right, as you look at it, are also buttons as well.
Oh, little clicky things. Are those infinite encoders, or do they have stops?
I'm not really sure. I suspect I don't really know, to be honest.
16 encoders for easy sequence input.
Yeah. I'm actually a big fan of just the knobby sequencer thing rather than something like the Winter Modular Eloquencer, where you're talking lots of buttons and screen. Big hands-on element over actually taking up a whole side of this module. That's nice. That's nice and cool.
But they're multifunctional. They're not just kind of you're sort of doing your pitch, sort of setting it up like that. As I say, they actually have their buttons, so you can actually actuate or switch them on and off. And they have other functions depending on what mode you've got it set in, and it's got memory.
Excellent.
Very interesting. And a microtonal tuning if you want to jam along Jacob Collier or a Turkish guitar.
If you want to get weird. What's that? Four channels, modulation kind of tracks. That's pretty cool as well.
Yeah, that was the other side of it. The fact that it was doing sort of gate modulation and CV. I think there was also, I got the impression from the thing, it doesn't seem to state it here, but I got the impression there was a sort of LFO kind of functionality that it had in respect to...
Oh, yeah, might maybe able to put an LFO on one of the mod tracks. That'd be pretty cool.
But yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, if you compare it with other things like the Metropolis and that, this is, you know, not too badly priced. And we've got a price of £539.99 UK.
I mean,
pounds.
Less of a weird approach than the Metropolis, but much, much more capable. Similar size, maybe touch wider potentially. I don't know the HP of the Metropolis off the top of my head. That's a compelling option.
But this looks very similar. I mean, sort of footprint wise, it looks almost identical. It's hard to really tell. I mean, as I always say with Eurorack, it's always a lot smaller in the flesh than it looks when you see it in video or in photographs.
Yeah, there's a little screen, isn't it? I wonder how little it is. I mean,
It shouldn't be too cramped. But yeah, that'll be cool. It is a chunk of money, but if you need a flexible sequencer, that's quite nice. Now, the one that we've mentioned before, but also speaking of Lupop, I did take a quick gander at his video for this one. It's the Korg SQ64, potentially briefly mentioned on one of the previous podcasts. I can't remember.
Yeah, but we briefly touched on it, or you mentioned it last week.
It looked pretty cool in terms of the workflow on it.
Actually doing something different, you know.
Well, the way they're portraying it, I did have a quick look on the Korg website, and they're sort of saying it's a kind of direct lineage. They had the SQ-10 and then the SQ-1, which is the more recent one, and now
the SQ-60. What's the SQ-10? Is that a vintage?
That's the original one that kind of accompanied the MS-20.
Oh, okay, cool.
We certainly mentioned it a good 10 episodes ago or something.
We're talking about knobby sequences, which I'm a fan of. This doesn't have any. This is all buttons. I don't know how much of a fan I am of it, but what is always cool about grid-based stuff is the interesting way that you can lay out a fake keyboard on there.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, a couple of things that caught my eye. The fact it's polyphonic, and also it's got, and I have to dive through the notes, but it's got some saccastic elements to it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think it's quite an interesting thing, and not too badly priced.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be head-to-head with the BeatStep Pro, which I personally could not get on with at all. I can't quite remember why.
I don't know what actually stochastic means. What is that?
It's a very good question. I know what it means. The other question is, can I describe to you what it means?
Ooh.
So off the top of my noggin, I think we're talking planned randomness in a way, but let's do a quick Google and see if I can spell stochastic right. Oh yeah, here we go. A stochastic or random process can be defined as a collection of random variables that is indexed by something boring maths on Wikipedia. So in musical terms, controlled randomness in sequencing. So it's fun for, the most common one of these would be probability per step. So 0 to 100%, will it trigger when it goes round? That one's always fun, especially for hi-hat patterns. You could just fill up a big 16 steps, and maybe there's a couple that you want to always happen, leave those on 100, and then just put some random percentages in the rest, and it keeps evolving and changing.
It's a way to trigger your creativity, guys.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's why I like things like the Turing Machine, is because I'm bad at writing music, and they help. So, stochasticisms, it's probably not a word.
Fantastic.
They're good
it.
In my book.
I mean, also saccastic comes in up with the thing that we talked about way early in the year, which was the Omsomics saccastic inspiration generator.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I'm checking today still isn't available.
Damn. Were you on the waiting list? Have you heard any? Well, any
yeah, sniffs? And I actually tried that. I actually noticed there was a new kind of email me when it's available kind of thing on that particular webpage, and I put my email in, and The website didn't work properly. It said something had gone wrong. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, I'm not over confident about seeing it anytime soon.
Didn't you pick up a Melodicer anyway?
Yes.
Simona, yeah.
Yeah.
So you got a bit of that kind of action going.
Yeah, and I'm just still curious about the Omsomic one. I may get one eventually if it ever surfaces and then find it's pretty much the same as the Verona one.
Favorite sequencer you've ever used, Pete?
Still the Metropolis, most probably.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you can always, you know what you've got. You know what it can do. And, there's just something about it. It's very accessible. It's not sort of very obtruse or anything like that. It's not one of these things that there's no menus. There's nothing to, it's very clockworky in some respects, but you can still get a sense of randomness out of it.
Yeah. Any other honourable mentions?
Well, obviously, the Turing Machine, which is a favourite.
It's on my list.
Another one I fancy was the one that you had, which the name escapes me.
The Euclidean circles.
Yes.
Yep, that would be my call as well.
I'm still sort of thinking about expecting to at some point get notified when the kits are available for those again for the Mark II.
Yeah, it's just so intuitive. I love it because it's so visual. It's pretty colours. Big rainbow, it was nice. I think the one I'd add to my list actually is incredibly cheap, though not currently produced anymore. Potentially Thunk might sell them. But the RYO Penta, it's a really simple five-step sequencer. It's got a clock, it's got a reset, it's got an output, and it's got a three-position toggle that changes it from 3 to 4 to 5 steps. Super simple, unquantized. Need a quantizer for it if you want to pitch stuff. But rewarding, small, easy, and cheap. That's all you need. Great fun for little bass lines or little riffs, and using the little toggle, you can do some odd time type stuff. And I used to pair that with the Euclidean circles to get some interesting rhythms as well.
So we're not going to see this SQ64 until next year at some point.
Oh, that's a bit lame.
So, but
I want to see a head-to-head.
Eventually we're going to see them We'll definitely have them in the store, so we'll get a chance to play around.
I hope one goes wrong so we can have an excuse to kind of test it for ages and get to know how it works. That's always fun.
Well, you know, we're going to get asked questions if we start selling these because of it. There is a degree of complexity on here. I know that I'm going to be fielding phone calls on it, on the subject.
That's always the way. Let's actually skip the next news thing. We'll tack it on to the end while we're going with the synth theme. Junkie XL having a big old synth sale. I was talking to ModCaf Ben about this. Not this ModCaf Ben, and also not the other ModCaf Ben, but the other ModCaf Ben.
Okay.
I was speaking to him about this today. He was thinking maybe, is he running out of money? Is that why he's shifting it? I mean, he did say he just doesn't use it, and he thinks it's kind of sad that it's chilling there, all his synths.
Yeah, I watched both videos because he did a sort of XL Junkie, or Junkie XL, I should say, video, and he also did a reverb one because that's where he's selling.
The reverb one's the one that I caught, yeah.
So the Junkie XL video actually explains a bit more of his thinking or philosophy over it. And it really is, and I can sympathize and understand this. It's the it's a guilt thing where you know he's going into the studio and seeing all this equipment and walking past it and not using it constantly. And he has got an awful lot of equipment. I mean, he's the ultimate
multi-platinum producer.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine he's short of money. If you look at his credits for the film scores and things like that, I really can't imagine he's short of cash, particularly unless he's got some sort of gambling habit or something.
Well, among them, a mint Jupiter 8, that's going to get him a bunch of cash.
Yeah. I mean, he explains that he was basically, he's been collecting this for nearly 40 years.
Stuff.
Yeah, he started as a teenager, but then he went on to work at a music shop and got the first dibs on all the secondhand stuff.
What have I seen that before?
Yeah.
Hashtag staff discount.
Well, he was giving examples that, at the end of the 80s, people were sort of trying to sort of chop in sort of memory Moogs, poly Moogs and things like that. They were being offered $50 for them.
Oh my God! Yeah, time like, to be alive.
Yeah, I mean, and he said that at the end of the '80s, he was buying stuff from the early '80s, and at the end of the '90s, he was buying stuff from the beginning of the '90s, and so forth. And he rode the wave. Yeah, and generally, he wasn't buying stuff when it was really hot. He was getting it at a later stage and really benefiting from it.
Yeah,
and as you say, some of the examples of things he's got are in excellent condition. But it's not just synths. I mean, it's guitars, drum kits. But he did go on to say that he's building a complete new studio.
Oh, nice.
So, and that will contain the sort of
the bits that stay.
Yeah, the bits that are absolutely essential to his work. But
did he go into what that kind of stuff was, what he was keeping?
No, but he said he'll be doing future videos on that, and he'll be doing videos on the new setup. But he went over, I think, on the Reverb one. I don't know is that the one you watched?
No, I had a quick skim of the article. I didn't actually watch the video.
With the Reverb one, he actually identifies various bits, and there are some classic pieces,
some rare Yamaha CS stuff.
Yeah, yes, there was quite a few things. It was definitely the CS60. And is there a 40 as well? I'm sure.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a 40 and a 60. And it looks like he's keeping the 80, so it looks like he had all three.
That's the good one to keep.
Well, yeah, but they're all very rare instruments. Yeah. I mean, most of the stuff that he showed, that and there was many other items, they're all extremely rare bits and pieces. Yeah. And each one had a story, and he detailed which film scores that he used them on and so forth.
Yeah,
so they've all got provenance.
There was a similar thing that I saw kind of go past, wishing I had cash. Nils Fram did a similar clear out of his studio with, what's that English synth refurbisher resellery type brand?
I don't know.
Neither do I. It's on Instagram, and I've deleted Instagram, so I
so it's
don't
UK,
remember at all.
UK one.
Yes. You know Fraser that we work with.
Yes.
He, I think. Through his work with that other one guy who I can't remember his name, the guy who did a bunch of Adele's piano, who came into the shop, Neil.
Okay.
You know Neil?
Not personally.
I sold him a grandmother, not my grandmother, obviously. He went to this place, and Fraser kind of knows about them through there. That's where he found his love for the Neon Egg Planetarium, I believe. But correct me if I'm wrong. So yeah, if only we had cash, we could get some serious synths.
Well, I didn't check the reverb actually and see exactly what's listed, but I could imagine. I mean,
it's going up on the 8th of December, I think.
And there's a lot of items because there was post-it notes, and I imagine that's all the instruments that are going to go up, and all around the studio is post-it notes on all various bits of equipment.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if he's going to be getting rid of things like the Moog modular stuff.
More difficult to get rid of, I imagine.
Well, yes, because of the sheer cost of it. Mm. And he's got a hell of a lot of it, and I would imagine he's mostly got a lot of the other third-party stuff.
Yeah.
There was some various other bits. Most of the stuff that he detailed was very sort of... there was some Lindrum stuff. All very sort of classic stuff. Not the stuff that I prefer. I mean, it's the sort of stuff that needs a lot of work, a lot of upkeep.
Yeah, always the way with the old analog stuff, anyway, isn't it?
But yeah, as I say, as he expressed that it sounds like he didn't pay a great deal for it in the first place. So,
damn him!
If he's going to sell this stuff for the current value, he's mostly going to do quite well out of it.
just a bit. Now, our final newsworthy section, a big old fire, which reminds me of that one time that one factory that made a hell of a lot of RAM went down quite a few years ago now, and everything got expensive.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see the same thing here.
Story.
I mean, I was aware of this a few weeks ago, and it is a story from a few weeks back in respect to the fire itself, but... at that time, I thought there was a bit of an embargo. There was a bit of sort of hush-hush about it because various manufacturers have been affected. But this is from a report. There was quite a few reports on the internet. So I thought, oh, well, it's quite a sort of significant thing. So let's pop it in. So back on 23rd of October, there was a fire that broke out at AKM's most important chip manufacturing facilities in I'm always terrible with these.
Oh, wait, let's have a gander. Where are we?
Nobika.
Nobika.
Yeah, Nobika in Japan. Basically, their chip plant, which exclusively makes their high-end DACs and ADCs.
Mm.
And
big brands affected on that one. So we've got SPL, SSL, and UAD, and that's probably only in the audio world, and probably not all of them.
Well, and also, I believe these converters are also used in other types of high-end hi-fis and so forth. But, I mean, for our point, we're only really concerned about the pro audio side of things. But, yeah, this is really going to have an impact. I mean, it wasn't a minor fire. It sounds like the facility is virtually destroyed. The fire raged for about 3 days. Luckily, nobody was hurt, none of the staff or any of the firefighters attending the fire. But the damage is extensive. It sounds like the building's actually sort of the roof and sort of some of the walls have collapsed.
Yeah, it's no good at all.
They're saying a minimum of 6 months to get the plant back up, and it was unique in the respect of the products it was making. So I think we're going to start seeing certainly shortages with sort of high-end audio interfaces and other devices. And also price rises.
Yeah. Well, luckily UAD will start to focus a little bit on their Big Sur update instead of actually keep on building.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I had a little issue this week with that, which really...
Oh, have you updated?
Yeah, I did without realizing.
Haven't you learned from Catalina?
Oh, boy. What have I done? Yeah, I did that.
Oh,
and
of
then
course. You've got UAD, haven't you?
My Apollo Twin started to play up. So it still works... relatively okay. Some of the plugins are have extra latency due to the fact that the software wasn't updated along. Mm. So I've contacted UAD and they did say that they're working tirelessly to get this latest update on Big Sur, which I better hope they do, because I think people just want to get back to work. I mean, I should have learned from previous...
Catalina!
That's it. But yeah, if you're wondering if your software has been affected with this new update of Big Sur, do check, whatever brand you're using, the website, and check on their updates and see what is it that you can do to actually kind of have things back to normal. I know that this has been affected with other brands like Arturia plugins or even firmware for interfaces like Focusrite and stuff like that. So we just have to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, I mean, if it's anything like the Catalina update, loads of brands all have a big thing on their front page going, don't do it, we haven't finished the drivers.
I know.
So, yeah, we should be okay. I mean, hopefully they'll
yeah.
Hopefully they'll get that one fixed. And now from the earthbound realm, I think it's time we delve into the stars with our navigator, Luke, in Luke's Spacey Bit.
Good evening or good morning, Rack Addicts. I am Luke, and I am here to talk about the death of radar astronomy. 2020's latest victim is the enormous and much-celebrated Arecibo Observatory, an iconic radio and radar telescope based in South America. The 305-metre aluminium dish was completed in 1963, built into a sinkhole in the Municipio de Arecibo, part of Puerto Rico's northern Atlantic coast. Suspended 150 metres above the dish by a series of tensioned cables is a platform containing the telescope's various sensitive scientific instruments. In 1997, the Gregorian Dome Mirror System was added, which increased the utility of the telescope, allowing it to see out in a broader set of directions and increasing the focus of the instrument, providing better quality images. This came at a cost, however, nearly doubling the weight of the suspension platform. More cables were added to compensate for the additional weight. Fast forward to August of this year, you may have heard that one of the newer cables from the 1997 refit recently broke away from one of the towers, swinging down onto the dish and trashing some of the aluminium plating and underlying structure. These cables are 7 centimetres in diameter. They're seriously heavy-duty lengths of metal, the sort of thing that holds up suspension bridges. I really, really wouldn't want to be anywhere near one of those when they broke away from their towers. At the time, this was reported to be an unfortunate but ultimately temporary setback, with repairs planned to commence shortly, restoring the facility to operation by early 2021. That was until another older cable from the original 1960s build broke away from the same tower on the 6th of November, further damaging the dish and placing more strain on the remaining cables. The NSF, the National Science Foundation, which is the organisation responsible for funding, maintaining and operating the facility, announced on the 19th of November that the plans to fix the telescope are now likely to be scrubbed in an effort to prioritise worker safety. Measurements of the load on the remaining cables have shown that they failed at about 60% of their projected tolerance, meaning the structural safety of the observatory has been brought into question. The models used to track the structural integrity of the telescope may have been deeply flawed. It is now feared that any further cable breakages could lead to a cascade event, bringing the whole superstructure down in an uncontrolled collapse. As a result, the NSF and other international backers have made the tough decision to abandon the facility and demolish the telescope before this can happen. If the facility was to be repaired now, the workers would have to take some precautions that come with their own inherent risks. One idea would be to lower workers from a helicopter so that they can safely be pulled away into the air should the structure collapse during these repairs. Given the facility's history with funding, however, it is likely that the far cheaper option of decommissioning and demolition will be prioritised. Arecibo has been battered by bad weather, particularly over the last 10 years, and the time to upgrade the suspension cables unfortunately seems to have passed us by. I would hope that some effort is made to replace Arecibo in the years to come. Some listeners may know of China's 500-metre FAST telescope, which recently eclipsed Arecibo as the largest radio telescope on Earth. However, Arecibo is the largest radar telescope, which means it can detect with great sensitivity the distance and orbit of near-Earth asteroids. It forms part of our asteroid detection system and gives us sufficient data to calculate a decade's worth of orbital trajectories for these objects. Arecibo is the best instrument we have to do this due to its size. The next best radar system is a 70-metre dish in Goldstone run by NASA's JPL. This is not to say that the Goldstone dish is not effective. Its size makes it much more manoeuvrable compared to the static 305-metre dish, but Arecibo, being so much bigger, has about 2 to 4 times the effective radar range in line with the inverse square law. I would actually encourage you to look at some of the radar images and videos of near-Earth asteroids taken by Arecibo. Though they might seem a little bit lo-fi compared to our modern standard, they're actually some of the best videos we have of asteroids in the solar system. And even though projects like Hayabusa and OSIRIS-REx are active, those kind of things are only very good at looking at one particular asteroid at a time, whereas an installation like Arecibo will view thousands of them over the course of its operational lifetime. So, Arecibo will be missed, but its legacy will certainly endure among astronomy and space enthusiasts. The facility was responsible for returning radar images of Saturn all the way from down here on Earth. It was also the first telescope to detect evidence of gravitational waves. It recorded radio emissions from a pulsar called CP1919 that eventually became the famous front cover of Joy Division's album Unknown Pleasures. Many people are also familiar with its likeness thanks to the many films for which it has become a set, such as Contact and GoldenEye, just to name two. Perhaps most incredulously, the Arecibo radar array was used to send a 23x73 pixel bitmap image via radio transmission off in the general direction of the Messier 13 cluster of stars, some 25,000 light years away. This was part of a 1974 SETI initiative to communicate with any stellar neighbours we might have. People who have read Sergeant Liu's Three-Body Problem may be reminded of similar attempts made by the fictional Red Coast facility, and filled with a certain sense of unease about shouting off into the void. Yet here we are, 46 years on, and still alone in the universe. Fortunately, Messier 13 won't hear our message for another 24,900 odd years, so neither you nor I will be around to hear a reply. Well, that concludes the segment for this week. I hope you've enjoyed learning a little bit about the rise, fall, and achievements of the Arecibo Observatory. Tune in next week for more space news, but for now, I'll leave you with my co-hosts for any other synthy business. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
And thank you, Luke. Another excellent delivery from... are we still in Stairwell Studios? I hope we are, because that's a good name. You need to hold on to that for your maybe future Birdsworth recordings, though you might not be able to fit the whole band in. There's a music video idea for you post-lockdown. You're on the top of the stairs with your cute little cocktail kit, and then the rest of the band arrange them down the stairs. You can pay me after you get the ad revenue. Anyway, thank you so much for extending our minds beyond this planet. Right. It brings us towards the end, unless... Telmo, do you have any musical words of wisdom?
I do. I've got a little album that I would like to share with you guys.
Ooh, nice.
It's a Joni Mitchell album from 1976.
Artist I've heard of.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't, make sure it's the first thing you do this evening or this morning, whatever you're watching at. Joni Mitchell's Hegira from 1976. It is adored mostly by the critics more than the actual fans. But I tell you why I like this album more.
Have you got the critic hat on while you're enjoying this, or you're just a more educated fan? Shots fired.
I think it's probably my educated hat talking a little bit more on this one, as I've always been a fan of her. But this album in particular, it's not only has got a sort of like a very particular sound. Joni is particularly known for incredible different guitar tunings, and the resonance that she implies for her guitars is just something that's very specific and very good and very special. This was written at the time when she was gigging and touring with the likes of Pat Metheny and Jaco Pastorius. For those who don't know, they're two of the biggest jazz legends. Unfortunately, Jaco is not with us anymore. But he, if you're a bass player, or if you've ever been in contact with a bass player, he will know.
If you've ever been in contact with a bass player. I love that.
They're rare. They will know who Jaco is. He's not only he's like the Jimi Hendrix of bass. No, this is just, it's an incredible, well-written album, composed on the road. It's the only album where Joni Mitchell wrote every tune for the guitar. And then everything else is surround that. As you might know, she also wrote a lot of stuff playing the piano and collaborating with other people. So Pastoria's genius was absolutely fully flowered in the fusion of this supergroup at the time called Weather Report. And you never really, you can really get the best. This is like literally the best Jaco Pastoria's melodic stuff that you can get out there. It's so nice. It's absolutely insane. Melodic lines are so inspiring. I totally recommend you to have a look at the opening track, Coyote. Songs like Amelia, which it's kind of like a bit of a reference to previous songs like Woodstock, which you guys might know, which is obviously based on the famous festival in 1969, which, by the way, she's never been, and she wrote the most iconic song.
That's quite
about
funny.
It. Yeah. So she certainly made more ambitious albums, and she made bigger productions, and she's an absolute legend. But this one in particular, it's definitely worth checking out for the reasons previously mentioned. So go and listen to it, Hegira.
Excellent. Thank you much, Lee Telmo, for your musical mind. And now, speaking of M's, we're going to go for our multimedia moment of recommendation. I can't remember what I called it a couple of weeks ago.
Recommendation.
Yeah, we got to go roll back a few episodes and I'll try and remember it. I do actually have one because I've been feeling very outdoorsy and spiritual-ish and relaxed and calm and happy. This is for the audio engineer-y type people, or people that mess around with DAWs at least. If you have a favourite ambient track, think of a nice ambient track that you know. The less percussion, the better. In fact, no percussion is ideal. Hopefully somewhere from the 5 to 10 minute range. Go onto the magical portal to the unknown called the internet and look for something called Paul Stretch. If you haven't encountered this program before, it's quite magical and ancient. Somebody has ported it to Mac. I think it's a Windows thing from a million years ago. What this does is you put any audio file into it, and you can stretch it as long as you want. So you may well have encountered on YouTube Shrek, but it's 24 hours long, or something stupid like that. People will just take songs and make them, you know, obscenely long audio files. What it does is it slices up whichever file you put in there into little chunks. You've got quite a lot of control over this, and it does some clever cross-fading and granularizing and strange maths to make this seamless, stretched ambient pad thing. It's really good fun to try.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
What I'd recommend is not to go overboard with it. Because if you stretch it loads and you go from... when I did it, I took like a 30-second file and stretched that. So I went maybe to about 30 minutes. And it is really boring because it's just like one sustained chord for maybe 5 minutes. And then it moves another one. It's kind of strange. Let's say it's that 30-second file. Try going to a minute and then try going to maybe two. That's kind of where the sweet spot might be, because you'll still have the movement in terms of the chords and the melody, but it'll just be super washed out and relaxing, and it's really good fun. But like I say, ambient stuff works best. If you have stuff with percussion, the transients do some very strange things, and it's not that pleasant. Ambient stuff only. Paul Stretch, have a blast. It's good fun if you want to have a little relaxing, light some incense, lie back on a beanbag and consume things, or not. Anyway, yes. What do you guys got?
Right, I've got one that I came across the other day. It's a YouTube channel, obviously, with my...
The extensive list.
Yeah, it has joined the extensive list. This is actually fresh, so it's something I picked
Hot
up on
press.
For a particular video, which I'll discuss in a minute. The channel on YouTube is called J3PO, and it's by a guy called Julian Polak, and he described himself as a keyboardist, producer, and audio engineer. Now, the particular video that caught my attention was he was doing an extensive comparison between the new Prophet 5/Prophet 10, he's actually got the Prophet 10, and the Prophet 6, which is we discussed that a couple of weeks ago. But he goes into excruciating detail. He programs them so, and he shows how, in some respects, they are sound exactly the same in some areas, and then are completely different.
Nice.
He has swayed me slightly with the vintage knob. I kind of understand
the vintage knob. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I was a bit sort of derogatory about it the other week, but he explains what it does. Although some of the stuff he did with it, he said, "Well, I wouldn't actually use that anyway." But because when you apply the vintage knob and you start getting the sort of slop, it's not just the oscillators; it does it with the envelopes and.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so you get all sorts of strange delays. But he did point out that the Prophet 6 has got a slop dial anyway, so you can do, but that only does the oscillators. Mm. And there's a whole variety of things that the Prophet 6 has got that the Prophet 5
like
stroke Prophet 10
has. Effects, sequential. Yeah. Effects.
Yes.
Why, anyway? I've had my rant about that.
Yeah, well, with the Prophet 5 and 10, they're being authentic, aren't they, as much as you can be, other than the fact it's got MIDI and the vintage knob.
And but the Prophet 10 isn't by Tambrel.
Yes.
And it doesn't have two keyboards.
Yes.
They failed so
yes.
badly.
But I still kind of think it's still overpriced. I stick with that. Did it need to be how expensive it is? But I can understand they're charging that because they can.
Mm.
But, I mean, it was interesting, and it's not just a brief thing. I think that one was about nearly an hour, but he goes into exquisite detail between the two, and they do, you know, he's got these certain patches, and they sound identical.
Yeah.
So my premise that, I'm happy sticking with my Prophet 6 holds.
Just to reassure you,
yeah.
That's all good then.
But and then he's got quite a few others that he does, quite a few synthy type of things, and there's other stuff. That's the only one I watched, but I thought, well, you know, the detail is gone there. The other videos on there have got to be of sort of reasonable. There's got to be some value in there anyway. So, yeah, that's my this week's recommendation.
That's
so
beautiful.
J3PO.
Excellent.
Wow.
Thank you much, Lee. Telmo, have you got another one that to deliver, or are you going to stick with your Joni Mitchell for today?
Well, I do have something that is not necessarily YouTube related, but I found it on YouTube.
We're multimedia, remember now.
Oh, yes, of course.
We've run out of YouTube.
My apologies, good sir. this is a Black Friday deal from iZotope. And I'm not being sponsored at all by the company. I'm just saying this is actually a really good deal.
iZotope, please sponsor our podcast. Thank you.
Do it. Do it. An incredible set of plugins priced at $999 was suddenly reduced to £40. You're hearing it right here. It's actually £40 plus VAT. iZotope is doing this massive deal on their main mixing and mastering plugins.
Ooh, so I have all the audio repair stuff.
Mm.
I always find myself reaching for it and remembering I only have their vocal thing. And
they
the vinyl
have
thing.
Great stuff. Yeah, the vinyl, everyone had. That's how I heard
it's
of
free.
iZotope. Yeah, yeah. It's great. I didn't personally get it, but my other half did, and she is loving it.
The vinyl or the big iZotope bundle?
The bundle itself.
Ooh,
yeah.
Nice.
She is using the Neutron, the Ozone, so and a bunch of other ones that came with the bundle. So it does sound amazing. It's some of the plugins that do this really cool thing of basically frequency analyzing and just cut off certain frequencies that you don't want it to be in a master. If you just want something quickly mastered or just mixed,
yeah.
You know, just put them through these plugins. Even if you're just starting, you know, if you just want to get something down with a decent sound quality, just buy the plugins today.
It does have all of their, some of their audio repair stuff. That's kind of annoying. Oh, no, the temptation. How could you do this to me, Tom?
I know.
Every time.
It's great, isn't it?
It is a
I mean, there are
great
a lot of
deal.
Really good Black Friday software deals.
Mm. Yeah, software is always
I haven't seen any other company doing things at this price, though.
No, that's quite significant. But, you know, I'll have to have a quick look on sort of Plugin Boutique and see what's going on in there. And I would say I'd have a look at Waves, but I've never gotten with Waves, not in the respect of how they work, but it never sort of worked well with my system. I used to have all sorts of crashes and weirdness going on. So I I don't go near it.
I know that you guys are more of a physical kind of players, and but I
not
do
for
a lot
mixing,
of,
not for mixing.
Yeah, you as I was going to say, you do need these tools for mixing and mastering at least. So
yeah, that's such a good deal.
Do it,
nice one. Well, thank you very much, and thank you to Telmo for saving everybody listening quite a lot of money if they're in that kind of market. Anyway, thank you for listening. This is episode 50, just a couple to go until we've hit the big year. Thank you for sticking with us, and as Nick Gowing seems to say at the end of his broadcast, because we've been doing some stuff with him recently, he just says, bye-bye.